The Federal News Update for Tuesday, December 2nd, 2025. Welcome, I'm Alex Johnson. And if you're trying to keep up with the sheer amount of news coming out of Washington, D.C. right now, you know it feels less like a steady stream and more like a fire hose. So today, we're going to dedicate this deep dive to trying to bring some structure, some context to just the last 48 hours. We're aiming for a complete and exhaustive look at every significant move from the executive, legislative, and judicial branches since midnight on December 1st.
And I'm Sam Kennedy. And Alex is right. We're not just aiming for a quick summary here. We're going to do a full structural analysis of this massive stack of source material. Because when you look at all the activity from just December 1st and 2nd, a really clear theme starts to emerge. We're calling it sovereign consolidation.
Sovereign consolidation. What do you mean by that exactly?
I mean, the federal government is aggressively, and you could even say ruthlessly, redefining its own power. It's defining its structure, its borders, and its alliances all at once.
So that's our mission today. We're going to treat these 2 days as a single, unified data set, really, to understand where the focus of federal power is right now.
Yeah.
And what we're seeing is a government that's simultaneously restructuring itself from the inside out, you know, through regulatory purges, workforce changes, while at the same time just radically redefining its relationships with the rest of the world.
Exactly. Through things like, well, unprecedented diplomatic confrontations and some really aggressive new claims of war powers. So the goal for you listening is to get a comprehensive, granular, and thoroughly analyzed report. We want to unpack the impact and the implications of every single move from, you know, high stakes geopolitics all the way down to the really technical but critical changes in federal IT.
Okay, let's unpack this. And I think we have to start with a foreign policy move. So openly hostile, it basically shatters foundational diplomatic etiquette. I'm talking about the U.S. taking over the G20 presidency.
That is absolutely the place to begin. On December 1st, 2025, the United States formally assumed the presidency of the Group of 20, the G20. They took the symbolic gavel from the preceding president, which was South Africa.
Now, normally, this is a moment for, you know, continuity. It's about shared goals. The G20 is supposed to be about global issues like debt or climate stability, sustainable development. But this administration, it seems, they've used this handover not for continuity, but as, well, an explicit declaration of ideological war against that global consensus.
The reframing is stark. I mean, it's impossible to miss. The upcoming summit in 2026, it's set for Miami, and it's meant to coincide with the America 250 celebrations. But the agenda they've laid out, it completely jettisons the traditional focus areas. They've built the whole thing on three very specific, and I would say radically different, pillars.
Okay, so what are these three pillars? Why are they so provocative?
The first is unleashing economic prosperity. And they define that very specifically as deep deregulation and tax cuts. The second is unlocking energy supply chains, which is, let's be blunt, a clear pivot right back to maximizing fossil fuel production, minimal constraints on coal and gas. And the third pillar is pioneering technologies, which basically mandates unencumbered innovation. It's about prioritizing speed over, say, safety or ethical governance.
And what's fascinating here is the explicit use of the G20, which is supposed to be about building consensus, to instead export a very specific brand of American economic libertarianism.
That's it. It's a direct frontal challenge to the established European model, for example, which says climate change has to be central to all economic planning.
So this signals that the U.S. won't be a neutral steward anymore. It's going to be a partisan ideologue for its own economic doctrine on the world stage.
And they didn't even wait for the summit to start the fight. It began immediately with what's being called the South Africa exclusion crisis. President Trump announced this really unprecedented decision that South Africa, the immediate past president and a key member of the G20 Troika, would not be getting an invitation to the Miami summit.
And just to clarify for everyone listening, the Troika is a critical part of how the G20 functions. Mm-hmm. It's the past, present, and future hosts. So excluding the immediate past host, that's not just a snub. It's like you're trying to sever the institutional memory of the entire body. It's a diplomatic decapitation.
Precisely. And the stated reason for doing it, that's what's so revealing about this administration's priorities. The White House cited allegations of human rights abuses against Afrikaners and descendants of European settlers in South Africa, specifically referencing things like land seizures and violence against farmers.
This is a huge political shift. You're seeing the formal internationalization of a very specific domestic political grievance narrative. Uh-huh. It's what many conservative outlets have been framing for years as a crisis of white genocide.
Right.
So the administration is taking these highly contested narratives, things that used to be confined to talk radio and social media, and they're making them the primary official driver of U.S. foreign policy. It's like they're transplanting U.S. culture wars onto the global stage.
And the economic coercion followed instantly. The president announced an immediate halt to all payments and subsidies to South Africa. The consequences of that are immediate and potentially devastating.
You mean for programs like AGOA?
Yes, exactly. It threatens their participation in the African Growth and Opportunity Act, AGOA, which gives them preferential trade access to the U.S. market. And critically, it halts PEPFAR funding.
And PEPFAR, the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief, has been a cornerstone of U.S.-Africa public health cooperation for decades. It saved millions of lives. Cutting that funding, which supports HIV/AIDS and malaria programs, it immediately destabilizes South Africa's public health system. And that's deeply unpopular, even with traditional Republican foreign policy thinkers.
But the administration seems willing to absorb that political cost. They see it as necessary to enforce this ideological boundary. This economic destabilization, targeting development and health aid, it's a calculated risk, and it could lead to severe internal instability in South Africa, which could, ironically, make the very violence the U.S. claims to be condemning even worse.
And South Africa's response was, as you'd expect, swift.
Oh, absolutely. President Cyril Ramaphosa immediately rejected the exclusion. He declared the country's G20 membership is, and I'm quoting here, in its own name and right, and not subject to a U.S. veto. The ruling party, the ANC, called it an act of imperial arrogance.
So what's the strategic fallout? Who benefits from this?
Well, here's the thing. This schism creates a huge immediate opening for rival global powers. South Africa is almost certainly going to leverage its deep membership in BRICS. That's Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa to deepen ties with Beijing and Moscow.
Of course. They can now present themselves to the entire global South as a victim of unilateral Western bullying, which directly undercuts U.S. influence and the G7 consensus.
So while the G20 was basically imploding, the administration was simultaneously running this very high stakes but much quieter diplomatic play on the war in Ukraine. We can call it the Russo-Ukrainian peace calculus.
Right, and that's a crucial contrast. So on November 30th and December 1st, Secretary of State Marco Rubio held these intensive four-hour talks in Florida with the Ukrainian delegation.
Yes, led by Defense Minister Rustem Umerov. The State Department's readout described the talks as productive, but they were very careful to add that work remains.
And the sequencing of these events, it really suggests an endgame is approaching fast. These talks with Kyiv seem like the final prep work before the administration sends its special envoy, Steve Witkoff, to Moscow for direct talks with Vladimir Putin.
The implication is heavy. By getting its terms with Kyiv squared away first, the U.S. is signaling it's now heavily invested in defining a framework for a negotiated settlement. This whole sequence puts maximum pressure on the Ukrainians to move away from their maximalist goals, you know, full territorial reclamation, including Crimea, and instead define what the U.S. would see as pragmatic endgame parameters.
And what would those pragmatic parameters actually look like on the ground?
It likely means the U.S. is pushing for some kind of freeze along the current lines of conflict. That, coupled with some form of long-term security guarantee for whatever territory Ukraine manages to hold on to.
And given that the U.S. holds all the cards when it comes to the flow of arms and money that are keeping Ukraine's defense alive,
it translates into immense political pressure on what are, for Ukraine, existential defense decisions.
So this raises a really important question about that influence of political pressure. If Washington is determined to get a quick peace deal, what's to stop them from just throttling the aid pipeline to force Kyiv's hand, no matter what the Ukrainians themselves think the risks are?
That is the core of the leverage. When they say work remaining, it probably means Kyiv is still resisting some of these parameters. Maybe it's the definition of the line of contact, or maybe the security guarantee being offered isn't strong enough. But the clock is definitely ticking before the U.S. envoy presents whatever deal has been hammered out to Moscow.
And all this is happening while the State Department is trying to maintain business as usual everywhere else. We saw Deputy Secretary Regas continuing a multi-nation tour through Turkey, Iraq, and Israel.
Right, which indicates a massive parallel effort to stabilize key relationships in the Middle East while Ukraine is dominating the headlines. Regus's trip was all about immediate regional security issues, shoring up alliances that have been pretty strained recently.
And you had Deputy Secretary Landau active on other files, meeting with officials from South Korea about North Korea and with the Serbian foreign minister to manage the complex European security situation.
It's a real balancing act. They're trying to pivot dramatically on their major alliances while simultaneously managing all this immediate instability elsewhere.
And that duality of action, these radical shifts externally, but this relentless operational tempo internally, that provides a really clear bridge to our next major theme. Because as the executive branch redefines its global role, it's also restructuring the administrative state and the federal workforce with, I would say, equal, if not ruthless, aggression.
And there's no clearer symbol of that internal restructuring, that appetite for austerity, than the quick, quiet end of DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency.
Ah, yes, DOGE. Originally framed as this controversial cost-cutting project, spearheaded by guidance from Elon Musk, it was officially dissolved ahead of schedule, and the news was kind of buried under all the diplomatic drama.
It was. But the human cost of that efficiency is monumental, and it really needs to be detailed. Reports are now estimating that because of the cessation of specific USAID-funded programs, over 600,000 excess global deaths may have occurred just since July of 2025.
600,000. This isn't just a budget line item. This is a catastrophic public health failure.
It really is. And if you break down where those cuts happen, DOGE primarily targeted programs that deal with high-volume, continuous aid. So areas like malaria prevention, HIV/AIDS treatment and drug distribution, and essential childhood vaccination campaigns in developing nations.
The argument from DOGE supporters was always about inefficient overhead or creating dependency. But for a disease like malaria, prevention requires sustained, predictable funding. You need bed nets, seasonal treatments. If that funding just stops, the disease prevalence snaps right back, and you see an immediate spike in mortality.
This is the grim math of efficiency. When institutional austerity targets humanitarian aid, the second-order effect is a massive, immediate public health crisis abroad. And now, domestically, Democratic lawmakers, particularly Senator Elizabeth Warren, are sounding the alarm.
And why is there so much domestic concern if DOGE itself has been dissolved?
Because the principles of DOGE, the mandates for zero-based budgeting, staff cuts, forced tech adoption without proper training, those ideas remain embedded within major domestic agencies. Think HHS, the Social Security Administration, the SSA.
So Warren's concern is that these embedded principles will lead to a kind of silent degradation of essential services for vulnerable Americans who rely on those benefits in healthcare processing.
Exactly. The project is officially over, but its legacy of austerity and bureaucratic decay is now an institutional feature, both globally with these humanitarian crises and domestically in weakened service infrastructure.
And moving from dismantling bureaucracy to restructuring the labor force, we saw this incredibly dramatic high-intensity enforcement campaign targeting the commercial trucking industry, the DOT's CDL enforcement blitz.
Transportation Secretary Sean P. Duffy initiated this blitz on December 1st. And while it was rhetorically framed as a safety initiative, its function is clearly intertwined with the administration's broader nativist labor policies, especially its anti-immigration stance. It's specifically focused on what they call non-domiciled CDL holders.
The actionable detail here is just,
yes,
it's astounding. It really speaks to the scale of the disruption. The Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, the FMCSA, executed a mass purge for its training provider registry.
They removed nearly 3,000 training providers immediately, just gone, and then placed another 4,500 on a proposed removal list.
So what does that add up to?
It means they essentially vaporized approximately 40% of the nation's authorized driver training infrastructure overnight.
And what were these providers, these so-called CDL mills, what were they actually doing that led to this? What standards did they fail?
The new standards of readiness targeted two main things: documentation fraud and proficiency failures. These mills were allegedly issuing CDLs using fraudulent foreign addresses, or they were issuing certificates for training that was either non-existent or just radically substandard.
So they were bypassing crucial safety checks.
And critically, the strict enforcement of English language proficiency for all CDL holders.
And the administration has explicitly linked this whole crackdown to a single fatal crash in Florida, where a non-domiciled driver who allegedly lacked proficiency made an illegal U-turn that killed three people. They're using that tragedy to justify this sweeping regulatory action.
And they're enforcing compliance through what you could call federalism as coercion. Minnesota was publicly singled out, threatened with the loss of $30.4 million in federal highway funding for issuing these non-domiciled CDLs.
And California is facing similar threats.
Even larger ones. Secretary Duffy's using the bully pulpit to accuse Democratic-led states of prioritizing migrant welfare over public safety.
What about the economic implications? I saw on December 1st, major carrier stocks like J.B. Hunt, they surged over 3%. The established industry seems to support this.
They do. The American Trucking Association's, the ATA, largely supports the crackdown. But that support is purely economic. The ATA sees these CDL mills and the low-cost non-domicile drivers as unfair competition that undercuts wages and drives down safety standards. So by removing 40% of the training capacity, the administration is basically acting as a regulatory moat builder, consolidating market power in favor of the large, established incumbent carriers.
But if you cut off 40% of the supply of new drivers, especially when the industry already has a driver shortage, what's the medium-term forecast?
Well, logistics analysts are sounding some severe warnings. The short-term benefit is market consolidation, sure, but the medium-term impact is a guaranteed severe driver shortage. That could emerge within 12 to 18 months.
And that shortage would translate directly into higher shipping costs.
And potentially reignite supply chain inflation across multiple consumer sectors. The administration is clearly prioritizing political and ideological goals here over long-term economic stability in this sector.
Okay, we need to shift gears now from physical infrastructure like trucking to the digital backbone of the federal government. I'm talking about cybersecurity modernization. There's this deep infrastructural problem that's creating huge friction for federal employees.
You're talking about the endemic problem of trusted internet connections version 2.0, or TIC 2.0. This framework, designed over a decade ago, it mandated that all federal agency internet traffic had to pass through a small, government-controlled number of access points. It's the classic castle and moat security architecture.
And the irony is that while it might have been effective for perimeter defense in a pre-cloud, pre-mobile work era, it's now a huge source of inefficiency. It creates what agency CTOs call the tic tacs.
The tic tacs is measured in two ways, in dollars and in latency. Financially, it relies on expensive private circuits, legacy VPNs, but the user-facing cost is that latency. The limited number of tic access points are mostly in or around Washington, D.C. So a federal employee working at an embassy in Asia or even just in a satellite office in California has to route all of their internet traffic back to a point near D.C. and then back out again.
And this is where it gets really interesting, because those delays from TIC 2.0, they aren't just technical. They are a felt cost for the end user. You can measure it directly in lost productivity and just sheer frustration. In a modern world where applications are measured in milliseconds, those cumulative delays, that backhauling, it degrades the user experience and undermines the very cloud efficiencies the government is trying to achieve.
And the solution being pushed now is the mandated adoption of TIC 3.0. This third version is designed specifically to overcome those castle and moat failures. It leverages two modern security frameworks, Secure Access Service Edge, or SACE, and Security Service Edge, or SSE.
Okay, so how does SaaS actually work to decentralize security and get rid of that tic tacs?
Instead of forcing all the traffic back to the DC castle, TIC 3.0 lets agencies implement a decentralized security model. So think of it not as one big moat around a central point, but as millions of microsecurity checks happening everywhere a user connects. It aligns perfectly with a modern zero-trust architecture, which operates on the principle of never trust, always verify.
So the security moves closer to the user and the data, which eliminates that wasteful backhaul. By adopting TIC 3.0, agencies can use cheaper broadband internet services, reduce their operational expenses, and minimize that latency that users feel every single day. It's a huge shift.
And moving from the digital backbone to the human backbone of the administration, we should probably review the aggressive legislation moving through the House Oversight Committee. It's all aimed at formalizing these workforce accountability changes the administration has been pushing.
The first bill that stands out is Representative Brandon Gill's Equal Ass Act. This one targets the civil service framework directly. It mandates a 2-year probationary period for almost all new federal employees.
Right, which doubles the typical probationary period. And that's crucial because during that time, an employee's appeal rights are severely limited, which makes termination much, much easier. But the key clause of the Equals Act is the certification requirement.
Tell us more about that. What is the certification?
In the last 30 days of that two-year period, the agency has to actively get OPM approval. They have to certify that the employee advances the public interest before they can become permanent.
And if that certification isn't made?
Termination is mandatory. This allows managers to consider a much broader set of criteria than just performance. It can include conduct, alignment with agency goals, a lot of subjective measures.
So this is basically a formal codification of the active sign-off process the president tried to initiate through an executive order. It makes it much harder to survive probation and easier to fire employees who are seen as, let's say, politically non-aligned.
Exactly. And the second piece of legislation is the Official Time Reporting Act, sponsored by Representative Virginia Fox, which targets federal employee unions. This bill compels agencies to provide incredibly granular detail on the use of official time by union reps.
And official time is the practice where federal employees, while on the clock, can conduct union activities like negotiating contracts or representing colleagues. Why is this reporting requirement so controversial?
The bill mandates that OPM and OMB compile and publicly release these annual reports. They have to detail the specific purpose of the time used by each employee, the exact amount of money withheld for union dues, and a detailed calculation of the cost of pay and benefits for employees while they're on that official time.
The stated goal is transparency, but unions, like AFGE, they see this as stigmatizing.
They do. They argue it deliberately mischaracterizes official time as taxpayer-funded union time, ignoring that labor-management relations are a statutory requirement. They'd say the activity is actually beneficial to the agency.
So it's an administrative tool designed to exert political pressure by quantifying and publicizing a cost that's normally just absorbed into agency budgets.
It adds friction to the whole collective bargaining process. And finally, there's the Federal Supervisor Education Act from Representative William Timmons, which mandates training for all federal managers.
And that training is specifically on?
It's mandated to cover performance management, how to handle unacceptable performance, addressing harassment, and, critically, how to properly use the new, longer probationary period under the Equals Act. It's all part of the same package, supporting the administration's accountability push.
We're already seeing these workforce issues playing out in the real world at the agency level. The CDC, for instance, aligning with the president's executive order on returning to the office, just unveiled a new telework policy.
And this new policy is severe. It limits telework to a maximum of 80 hours per year. That's about 2 weeks of full-time work. And it explicitly excludes regular or full-time telework as a reasonable accommodation. It's an immediate hard pivot back to a traditional office environment.
And the friction from that shift is intense. I've read the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, is facing a month-long backlog of reasonable accommodation requests from employees who can't easily return to a full in-person schedule.
So this push for an immediate return is creating significant administrative and legal strain on agencies that are already dealing with staffing shortages.
And that strain brings us to what has become, I think without question, the most ethically, legally, and politically charged story of the last 48 hours. The whole controversy around Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and the debate over the legal limits of war powers.
It's an incredibly complex situation. It centers on a report from the Washington Post about a boat strike on September 2nd against an alleged drug trafficking vessel in the Caribbean. And the core chilling allegation is that Secretary Hegseth ordered the military to kill everybody on that boat.
The details in the reports are just horrific. The first strike apparently left two survivors clinging to the wreckage. They were injured, defenseless, technically out of the fight.
And the Special Operations Commander, Admiral Frank Bradley, reportedly ordered a second strike specifically to comply with Hegseth's directive, ensuring everyone on board was killed.
So on December 1st, the White House confirmed the strikes happened. The press secretary, Caroline Leavitt, she defended the action by claiming the U.S. is in a non-international armed conflict, a NIAC, with narco-terrorist groups, and that the actions were therefore legal under the laws of war.
And this is where the legal justification comes under intense scrutiny. Declaring an NIAC is a very specific legal term of art. It's not just calling someone a terrorist. It legally redefines the conflict, which grants the military the authority to target and kill. But the issue is, NIAC status typically requires a non-state actor to have a certain level of organization and sustain military activity against the U.S.
So the legal pushback is arguing that a single drug boat, even if it's tied to a cartel, doesn't meet that threshold. It can't be treated as a legitimate combatant force in an ongoing armed conflict.
Exactly. Legal experts, former military officials, lawmakers from both parties. they universally labeled that second strike as a potential war crime or an extrajudicial killing.
Because the two survivors, clinging to the wreckage, were considered hors de combat.
Right, meaning out of the fight. They were disarmed and posed no imminent threat. The laws of war strictly prohibit targeting individuals in that state.
Former Defense Secretary Leon Panetta said explicitly that if the second strike happened as reported, that's a war crime. And we saw significant bipartisan pushback on Capitol Hill.
Critically, Republican lawmakers joined in condemning it. Representative Mike Turner, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, expressed deep concern. And Representative Don Bacon, a decorated former Air Force Brigadier General, called the action illegal and a clear violation of the law of war. He emphasized that killing survivors who pose no threat is fundamentally unacceptable.
This crisis must be creating profound legal anxiety within the armed forces themselves.
The reports indicate a significant uptick in calls to something called the Orders Project, which provides legal advice to military personnel. Service members are calling because they fear being asked to carry out what they believe may be an illegal order.
And their fear is twofold.
Yes. First, personal legal jeopardy. Carrying out an unlawful command can lead to a court-martial. Second, they're reportedly being pressured by political appointees to just adopt the administration's aggressive legal framing that these are the enemy, and they risk their careers if they adhere to their own professional military judgment and legal training.
And the scale of this operation is huge. 21 strikes since September, at least 83 deaths, all justified under this aggressive interpretation of NIAIC authority.
So in response, the chairs and ranking members of both the House and Senate Armed Services Committees have pledged vigorous oversight. This signals a unified congressional front to check this executive authority.
And that threat of oversight quickly became a concrete legislative threat. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer, along with Senators Tim Kaine and, interestingly, Rand Paul, threatened to file a war powers resolution.
This is a major procedural weapon. A war powers resolution would force a congressional vote to block any further military use of troops or kinetic strikes in Venezuela. And that bipartisan sponsorship with both a liberal Democrat like Kaine and a libertarian Republican like Paul shows a rare coalition unified against this unilateral expansion of presidential war powers.
And the whole Hegseth controversy is just underscored by this massive strategic dissonance, which seems to undermine the administration's stated purpose of combating drug trafficking.
The dissonance is staggering. On one hand, the administration is aggressively targeting alleged Venezuelan drug boats, conducting these strikes to combat narco-terrorism. But on the other hand, the president simultaneously pardoned a major convicted Honduran drug lord.
So why pardon a convicted facilitator of mass cocaine shipments while you're ramping up military action against alleged traffickers? It makes the stated rationale ring hollow. The implied motive seems to shift from drug enforcement to something else, maybe a geopolitical proxy fight or just political optics.
It also exposes a really deep rift in the Republican Party. While traditional allies defend the strikes, you know, citing the need to combat drug trafficking and Chinese influence, key Republicans like Turner, Bacon, and Paul are prioritizing legality and constitutional checks on power. They're showing a rare independence from the White House on military engagement.
Okay, shifting focus now to the legislative branch. While the executive was pushing all this polarizing policy, the House of Representatives actually managed to achieve some surprising, genuine bipartisan progress on December 1st.
Yes, and this is the function of Congress that often gets overshadowed. The House passed several bills under suspension of the rules, which is a process reserved for non-controversial measures that need a two-thirds supermajority to pass. It proves genuine consensus.
So let's look at what they passed. First, the Trafficking Survivors Relief Act. What does that do?
This act allows victims of human trafficking to petition a court to vacate federal convictions for nonviolent crimes, like drug or prostitution offenses, that were committed while they were under coercion by their traffickers. It's a rare convergence of progressive criminal justice reform and conservative anti-trafficking advocacy.
They also passed the Investing in All of America Act.
Right, which incentivizes small business investment companies to invest specifically in rural manufacturing and defense technologies. It's a form of industrial policy that aligns with the America First strategy of directing capital to strengthen the domestic industrial base outside of major cities.
And the Made in America Manufacturing Finance Act passed, which is an immediate boost for manufacturers.
It raises the maximum Small Business Administration, or SBA, loan limits to $10 million for manufacturers. It's a direct credit expansion intended to help reshore supply chains by giving domestic producers more access to capital.
And finally, the SBA Fraud Enforcement Extension Act.
This one extends the statute of limitations for COVID-era fraud to 10 years. It signals a unified, bipartisan posture on clawing back improperly distributed pandemic stimulus funds. So, you know, beneath all the political noise, some targeted, impactful legislation is still moving forward.
However, not all legislative work is going so smoothly. We're seeing a major showdown brewing over the must-pass National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA, specifically about artificial intelligence regulation.
This is a big one. The conflict involves a push from the White House and some House GOP leaders to include a provision in the 2026 NDAA that would ban or preempt all state-level AI regulations.
The administration's argument is that they can't have a patchwork of 50 state regulatory regimes stifling innovation. They want a single federal standard for AI.
But the opposition is significant. It's drawing from both federalism concerns and privacy advocacy. Over 200 state lawmakers from across the country sent a powerful letter to Congress urging them to reject this preemption clause.
And why are the states so insistent on keeping their regulatory authority over AI?
Because the federal government has failed to pass comprehensive laws on digital privacy, biometric data, or algorithm transparency. So states like California, Colorado, and others are trying to fill that vacuum, focusing on consumer protection, algorithmic bias in hiring, that kind of thing. They argue a broad federal preemption would just freeze all that progress. And this created a really interesting bipartisan split in Congress. You have tech-skeptical Republicans like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Chip Roy, who are opposing the measure. They argue it violates federalism and favors big tech innovation over consumer safeguards. It's a very complex ideological fight being crammed into the Defense Act.
And moving to healthcare, a critical deadline is looming. Enhanced Affordable Care Act, or ACA, premium subsidies are set to expire by Christmas, and there's a complete stalemate.
These enhanced subsidies, which keep premiums affordable for millions of Americans, they were extended before, but now they face a hard expiration date. The central roadblock is the Republican demand to attach specific anti-abortion riders.
And this goes beyond the traditional Hyde Amendment,
right? Yeah, that's right. The Hyde Amendment prevents federal funds from directly paying for abortions, but it doesn't stop federally subsidized ACA MarketCase plans from offering that coverage if it's funded by private dollars. Anti-abortion activists are now demanding riders that would totally prohibit any federally funded marketplace plan from covering abortion procedures or medications. It would effectively remove that coverage option from millions of enrollees.
Senate Majority Leader John Thune expressed deep pessimism about reaching a deal before Christmas because of this. It's an ideological battle where Republicans are fractured. A big group wants to avoid the economic pain of the subsidies expiring, but a strong ideological wing sees the subsidies themselves as a policy they just have to dismantle.
Which has led to some specific Republican alternatives being proposed. Senator Bill Cassidy is working on a bill to convert ACA tax credits into contributions to health savings accounts, or HSAs.
And Senator Rick Scott pitched the creation of Trump Health Freedom Accounts.
Scott's proposal is explicitly designed to be Hyde compliant, offering individual accounts that restrict the use of funds on any health plans or services that cover abortions. But while these appeal to the conservative base, they face solid Democratic opposition.
Now let's turn our attention to the judicial branch, which is wrestling with the fundamental architecture of the administrative state, especially in the shadow of the landmark Loper-Bright decision from earlier this year.
On December 1st, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in two pivotal cases. The first was Cox Communications versus Sony Music Entertainment. This is a case that could fundamentally reshape the economics and architecture of the internet by defining an ISP's liability for its subscribers' copyright infringement.
The core question is whether Cox, by continuing to provide service to subscribers who are known repeat infringers, is materially contributing to that infringement, which would make them liable for damages.
Cox's legal argument is that they are just a neutral tool, a common carrier. Their service is like a hammer. They shouldn't be held responsible if a user commits a crime with it. They argue that imposing liability would force them to become the internet police.
And Sony Music's counterargument.
Sony, supported by a lot of content creators and the Solicitor General, countered that Cox is not a neutral utility. They argue Cox is a massive beneficiary of piracy, that they deliberately ignore infringement notices to preserve their subscription revenue.
A ruling for Sony could mean ISPs have to adopt these aggressive terminal non-accusation policies.
It would fundamentally reshape the internet. Conversely, a ruling for Cox would solidify the conduit defense for ISPs, but make it much harder for copyright holders to enforce their rights.
And the second major case was Urias Orellana versus Bondi, which is about the standard of review federal courts apply to persecution determinations made by the Board of Immigration Appeals, or BIA.
Right. The petitioner, Urias Orellana, argues that after Loper-Bright, the court should apply de novo review, a fresh look to the BIA's definition of persecution. They're saying it's a legal standard that courts, not agencies, have to define.
But Attorney General Pam Bondi personally defended the administration, arguing fiercely for agency deference, for substantial evidence review, which means courts have to defer to the BIA if there's any plausible evidence to support their finding.
And this presents a fascinating strategic irony. This administration is usually the most aggressive opponent of the administrative state. They want to dismantle agency power with rulings like Loper-Bright. But in this specific case, they are arguing robustly for agency deference.
Why the reversal?
It's a purely pragmatic legal maneuver. It's tied to their strict immigration agenda. They want maximum efficiency in their deportation machinery. De novo review would invite thousands of BIA decisions to be relitigated in federal courts, which would overwhelm dockets and paralyze their enforcement agenda. Substantial evidence review lets the BIA operate at maximum speed with minimal judicial interference.
And speaking of legal maneuvering, the executive branch suffered a clear legal setback in the appellate courts on December 1st. The Third Circuit upheld the disqualification of Alina Haba as U.S. Attorney for New Jersey.
It did. And the decision rejected what the court called the administration's novel series of legal and personnel moves that were designed to keep her in that Senate-confirmed position after her interim term expired without confirmation.
It was a very complex shuffle. The Attorney General fired the successor chosen by the judges, the White House withdrew her formal nomination, and then immediately reappointed her as first assistant with top prosecutor powers.
And the appeals panel unanimously ruled that this whole maneuver runs afoul of the plain text of the Federal Vacancies Reform Act. It's part of a broader pattern of judicial resistance to the executive branch trying to fill critical Senate-confirmed posts with loyalists without getting congressional approval. The judiciary is actively enforcing that check on power.
All right, let's pivot now from the specific legal and policy details to the broader political battles and societal undercurrents that are driving the national conversation.
Yeah.
Because these undercurrents really dictate where the policy focus goes next.
And the special election in Tennessee's 7th Congressional District, TN7, on Tuesday is a major political stress test. This race has unexpectedly become a bellwether for the 2026 midterms.
It's a deep red district. President Trump won it by 22 points. The Republican candidate, Matt Van Epps, is a MAGA-aligned West Point grad. He's running against Democrat Afton Ben, a progressive activist they're calling the AOC of the South.
And the stunning fact is that the polling shows this traditionally ruby-red district is now a statistical tie.
So why should a voter outside of TN7 care about this specific race?
Because it's the purest manifestation of a national trend. It's a battle between two forms of populist outrage. You have the established MAGA outrage focused on cultural issues, and the border running headfirst into a progressive disruption driven by this acute left-wing anger over things like housing affordability, healthcare access, and economic justice.
So if Democrats can even keep the margin tight, say, in the single digits, in a district Trump won by 22 points, it signals that the political needle is decisively moving. Moving away from right-wing identity-based anger toward left-wing cost-of-living-based anger. That would make the overall political environment extremely favorable for Democrats heading into 2026.
And if we want to understand the tone of the current political environment, we really need to look no further than the Oxford word of the year for 2025, rage bait.
Rage bait, content that is deliberately engineered to provoke anger or outrage, not to inform, but to increase engagement and profit. And usage of the term apparently tripled this year.
It reflects a grim reality that our policy discourse is fundamentally broken. We see these huge issues that affect affordability and healthcare being constantly overshadowed by inflammatory high-emotion topics.
Like the Hegseth strikes being discussed in terms of war crime outrage, rather than the actual effectiveness or legality of counter-narcotics policy, or the focus on the president's recent MRI results, which became a national spectacle instead of a focus on his actions.
It means problems are exploited rather than solved. The focus constantly shifts to maximum heat, minimum light. When we discuss the border, the focus immediately jumps to politically charged narratives around the recent murder of a National Guard member, used as rage bait for xenophobic narratives, rather than engaging in a systemic discussion about assimilation or border infrastructure.
And before we conclude, there's one major societal undercurrent tied directly to past government action that needs attention. The plight of the forgotten GM bailout victims.
This involves about 640 people who suffered serious injuries or deaths from defective General Motors cars following the 2008-2009 corporate bailout.
It's a story of government priorities. The Treasury, through TARP, converted $50 billion into a majority ownership stake in GM to make sure the corporation survived. But in doing so, the government effectively shielded itself and the new GM from legal liability stemming from past defects.
Which left the victims, people with catastrophic injuries like quadriplegia, loss of limbs, death due to faulty ignition switches, it left them to receive mere pennies on the dollar from the limited bankruptcy estate of old GM. The government protected the corporation while abandoning the citizens who were injured.
Their claims for just compensation were denied. It remains this open wound in the relationship between citizens and the state, showcasing the human cost when corporate bailouts deprioritize accountability to the public.
And now there's a bipartisan bill, the Auto Bailout Accident Victims Recovery Act, introduced by Representatives Barry Moore and Troy Carter, seeking just compensation for these victims over 15 years later.
So if we connect all of this to the bigger picture, the entire scope of federal activity since December 1st shows a government that is just relentlessly focused on consolidating sovereign power, internally and externally.
Absolutely. They're determining who belongs through strict nativist labor policies like the CDL blitz. They are determining who pays by radically redefining the G20 agenda to export deregulation. And they are determining who governs through legal maneuvering that keeps getting checked by the judiciary, like with the Habba ruling. Every action is about hardening the borders and maximizing the central authority's speed.
It's this constant grinding tension between political speed and institutional law, which is what makes the Hegseth controversy so illustrative. The executive is pushing policy right up to and arguably over the established legal line, whether it's the laws of war, civil service requirements, or the constitutional mandate for Senate confirmation. The pressure point is everywhere.
Which raises an important question. If the government, across multiple fronts, is increasingly asking its agents and its service members to bypass or redefine established legal frameworks, from, you know, procurement regulations all the way up to the very laws of war, what is the long-term cost to the integrity and the effectiveness of the administrative state itself? That's something for you to mull over as we watch whether these pledges of vigorous congressional oversight can meaningfully check this accelerating consolidation of executive power as we head into the end of the year.
A compelling and critical thought. Thank you for joining us for this exhaustive deep dive into the actions of December 1st and 2nd, 2025. We will be back soon to unpack the next wave of federal activity.